The Naive Theater of the Air presents Rewired by Matthew Broyles. Episode 26, A Leaf on the Wind.
Faint notes floated aloft, meandering lazily through the walls between sleep and consciousness. Slowly, they took form, congealing around a familiar shape in his mind. A mockingbird. He did not open his eyes immediately, instead reaching out towards the other side of the bed. Finding only rumpled sheets, he drew himself back into the warm cocoon of sleep. In vain. Waking without her was unusual, and his mind did not tolerate anomalies peacefully. He peeked out from under the blankets to take a quick reading of the glow leaking out through thin fissures between the heavy curtains. Estimating late morning, he opened both eyes to read the wooden clock on the far wall. 11:30. Earlier than he generally rose, but not outrageous. The cabin was silent, but for the song of their nesting neighbors in the trees outside. No wind disturbed its branches today. And from the bright hue of the sunlight, he guessed that the brief Texas spring was nearing its end, ushering in the next 6 months of solar supremacy. He'd had the dream again. It was not an unusual occurrence, but ever since Aeolian, he always took special note of when it occurred. This time, he had almost found the door. The thought gave him a moment of unease. He wasn't sure he wanted to know what was behind it. Rising at last, he ran a hand through his beard, glanced around the loft bedroom. Below, he could smell coffee steaming up through the boards, twined with a hint of bacon. He hoped his nose wasn't deceiving him. Descending the stairs, he made a note not to trip on the stack of books he had piled up by the recliner, promptly forgetting as soon as he drew near. He bit back a curse as the pain shot through his toe and possessed his whole leg for an excruciating moment. Casting his glance around, he saw that he was indeed alone. How long she had been gone was difficult to say. The coffee was warm, but not overly so. Four pieces of bacon had been thoughtfully placed next to the pot. He relaxed. Whatever her reasons for going out, at least she wasn't mad at him. Settling down at their small dining table, the gears in Harry Seldon's mind began their slow chug towards wakefulness. Savoring the bacon between coffee sips, he reminded himself again to be grateful. Situated in a rural valley west of Fredericksburg, well off the paved road, the cabin had kept them safe for 5 years. It was a much better deal than he'd expected to get after the whole calamity. 6 days into his interrogation, somehow he'd gotten them to see it his way. Or rather, Colonel Haley had. To his unbounded relief, Harry's lucky guess had proved right. Dr. Lilly's adjustments to the ODA were deep, bedrock-level alterations that, if fully deployed, could have undone the rewiring procedure on everyone within earshot, both in person and remotely, and possibly beyond. The sonic component was something Harry could not have deduced, but he wasn't going to fiddle about with particulars. In the end, Haley mostly wanted he and Nina out of the way. Totally spent by the ordeal, he wanted to retire, but he was the only one in the Army leadership, or even among the Governor's Council, who believed Harry should be set free. A deal was made. Harry and Nina would be smuggled across to an underground rewired enclave in Ciudad Juarez, and Haley would lay down his command. Fortunately for the embattled pair, Levi Haley lied. The Colonel had bought the hill country land years ago from wizard people magnate Franco Baltierra as a retirement plan. The cabin was already there, surrounded by a thick forest dotted with the Pot Baron's signature crop. Haley's own cabin was over the hill in an adjacent valley, and he seldom emerged. Apart from occasional dedications for buildings named after either him or Major Levine, Colonel Haley had left the world behind. He had no more need of it. Harry Nina's cabin was initially shared by Mist, also against the dictates of the council deal. He succumbed to a brain tumor 1 year later. Nina doted on him till the end. Whatever his youthful crimes, she saw only the father figure she never had, and grieved deeply at his passing. Technically, they did not have an address, but Haley's trusted officers forwarded messages from those few who knew of their Texas residency. Finishing his coffee, Harry rose and retrieved one in particular from a nearby shelf. He didn't know what to make of the stories at first. Word came from spies in the wired world, providing murky details of the massive Washington shakeup that followed Lily's death. Then came sightings from within Texas's borders, back before San Angelo and Midland territories pulled away from the VEF-controlled Lubbock, Amarillo, and Abilene territories, forming the Republic of South Texas. The woman was spotted several times, visiting Lily's gravesite and asking questions in sensitive places, all of which raised her profile on the intelligence scope, which, as it turned out, was her goal. The missive he now held issued from the secret lab set up by Haley in the mountains outside Fort Davis. As far as the governors knew, it was occupied only by Dr. Dalal and his assistant, the young former VEF member Curtis Baer, whom Haley had placed into Dalal's care after capturing him at the Fort Walters attack. But in truth, the lab was a joint operation between Dalal and Dr. Vinson, dedicated to the further study of the Vorn phenomenon. Nina's rejection of their requests for monitoring were a bi-yearly occurrence, and he was proud of her for it. This message was printed on the lab's letterhead, embossed simply with two dots separated by a line. Below the insignia, a hand had written in lithe script,
"I am a leaf on the wind."
Harry smiled. He hoped that with their combined expertise, the three doctors could bring his enigmatic visitor some peace. Indirectly, he was responsible for their rendezvous. In return for secret amnesty from Haley, he had agreed to sift through Dr. Lilly's writings and communications in search of anything that might prove useful to the new lab. To his surprise, he found a message from Neidhart, sent mere minutes before Lily's death. He often wondered to himself how differently things would have gone if Lily had read it. He wondered things like that a lot. There were 100 potential turning points in the whole saga, and each of them carried their own bag of consequences. He remembered the Vorn Queen's description of manifold paths, and wondered if in a universe nearby and yet out of reach, another Harry was cleaning up a different mess. Or was dead. They'd lucked out. A few Republic soldiers less, and the Aeolian lab would have been taken. The fact that the assailants were busy attacking each other helped, of course, and the death toll was high, much too high for Harry's comfort. His mind had trouble, even now, fathoming the forces that would drive fellow citizens towards each other's throats with such ferocity. For the millionth time, he lamented Brooklyn. Not gone, but not the same. Effectively a theocracy now, ruled by the iron dogma of Chairman Caravelli, thrust into power after Weiss's ouster at the hands of the disciples. What the VEF had done to the Northern Texas territories, the Vorn worshippers were doing to his homeland. Oddly, the increase in fundamentalism corresponded with a drawdown of wired border presence on both republics. Like Free Detroit of old, the breakaway territories were now too undesirable for reabsorption. He would not think about Free Detroit. Not now. A shadow trundled back and forth under the rear window curtain. Harry grinned. Danny wanted in. Ricky Cutler's old dog was discovered snuffling through trash at the Fort Walters perimeter base, and after being identified by his tag, got sent along to Haley. The colonel couldn't bring himself to attach emotionally to anyone or anything anymore, so custody passed to Nina. The old basset hound was slow and arthritic now, but according to Mist, he hadn't ever been particularly vivacious. Harry rose and opened the back door, reaching down to pet Danny as he waddled in, wagging his tail. Danny, who wouldn't be there if not for Harry's father. But then the same could be said for Harry. Eyeing the note from Neidhart again, he thought about the chain of events that had brought him here. No matter how he ran it through his brain, it all came down to the inscrutable Dr. Barrett. There was still no consensus on precisely what he was attempting to accomplish by setting this international incident in motion. But considering the situation in light of what he knew about Dr. Neidhart's psychological predicament, Harry wondered if Barrett might have been after the same thing. A cure for the ghosts that haunted him. Then again, knowing what he did about Barrett, it could just as easily have been spite. The world would never know for sure. From the corner of his eye, he caught sight of her on the back porch, chair turned towards the woods. In rugged jeans, sweatshirt, and kerchief, Nina was still beautiful. She was forever apologizing for not having any makeup and for the cheap clothing she wore. He couldn't have cared less. Harry still saw her through the eyes of a 28-year-old virgin, resigned forever to furtive celibacy until this smart, brave girl had stormed into his life and changed his fate in so many ways. He knew he would die loving her, no matter what happened. He walked up behind her, just loud enough to be heard, and gently rubbed her shoulders. She leaned her head over against his right hand. Her cheek was wet.
You okay?
He's dead.
Nina lifted a handwritten note into his left hand. He read it, scarcely believing the words as they registered in his mind.
The colonel passed early Tuesday morning in his sleep. Estimated 7-day window to implement Plan B. I'm very sorry.
Harry's chest tightened. The writing was that of Captain Carlos Aguilar, one of Haley's last remaining safe information conduits. Plan B was his, and he knew very well how dangerous it was. If he thought that was the only option, he was probably right. Without removing his hand from Nina's cheek, he pulled up a chair and sat down, winded from the news. Neither spoke for several minutes.
I don't want to go.
Me either.
He fought his instinct to dissect the situation aloud. It was she who had taught him the difference between listening time and discussion time. He would listen to her unhappiness and wait. Slumping onto the porch, she leaned her head on his knee. He stroked her hair in a vain attempt at consolation. Her tears were clearly remnants of an earlier big cry, and Harry was sorry he hadn't been awake to comfort her. She'd experienced so little stability in her life, and now this oasis was being taken as well. It wasn't fair. It never was. After a time, Nina sat up straight, wiping her eyes. Her composure recovered. She finally met his gaze.
I don't think we should wait 7 days.
No. Graham won't waste any time tracking us down now that Haley's gone.
Making enemies was not something Harry ever set out to do. But in removing the possibility of remote wiring from Collie's people, he inadvertently committed a grave slight against the honor of Major Levine, at least in the mind of Captain Stacy Graham, commander of the Odessa garrison. Colonel Gonzalez did not hold a particular grudge against him, but the new army chief was still under the impression that they were in Mexico. From Aguilar's occasional briefs, Graham was not so certain. And out in the wastes of southwest Texas, her vengeance was unlikely to be checked from above. There were days when Harry didn't forgive himself either. Collie's resolve proved to be stronger than even he imagined, and it was difficult not to take what historians now referred to as the Free Detroit Holocaust personally. Shaking the guilt off, he reminded himself that there was no way he could have known about the kill switch that she'd built into the wires placed to all her citizens who wished to rejoin wired society. The vast majority, it turned out. Harry suspected Shinoda's hand in the technology, although few records survive the subsequent purge by the occupying U.S. forces. The diaspora's future was more uncertain than ever, and now even the tiny thread of safety Nina and Harry had enjoyed these past 5 years had frayed. The Republic of Northwest Texas was not an option, given that the two of them were highly positioned on the VEF's target list, not to mention the fact that it was in the throes of the sort of instability one might expect from a people attempting to wage war on invisible parasites. Brooklyn's ruling disciples were no friends either, even if the couple could somehow make it through U.S. territory, an unlikely prospect considering the hefty prices on their heads. As strange as it sounded, Plan B was indeed the safest option available to them. Yet here, they only had Captain Aguilar's word to go on. According to him, the underground rewired enclave in Juarez, originally chosen by the Council for their exile, was chiefly operated by Aguilar's family, with whom he had reconnected following the Lily ordeal. There they would reconnect eventually with Vinson, whose cover was now in danger as well. Hiding out in a Mexican border town was not Harry's first choice, but then his choice had been made on that dark day 5 years prior, and his life would be spent living out the consequences. Nina stood, offering him her hand. He took it and rose, his determination growing. Like Dr. Lily, he had cheated death many times. Any extra years he could get gave him more time to protect Nina. Harry Seldon's spark would have to be pried from his cold, dead hands.
I'll pack.
Sighing, Harry walked around to the stable. The horses were gifts from Haley, true to his firm belief that recreation should also be useful. Harry and Nina rode them regularly, both for fun and with the knowledge that this very day was coming for them. Harry hoped there was enough water and grazing between them and their destination to make the hardy paint's journey as pleasant as possible. His mind traced the route once more, well aware of the barren landscape ahead. Blessedly, the summer was not yet fully upon them. And on a note of pride, he stroked his flattened belly, the result of a 100-pound weight loss over the past few years. This reduction was as beneficial to the horse as to him. Shoveling some hay into the feeder, Harry reflected that his ironic job as shadow curator of the Waylon Lilly Library in San Angelo was now at an end. The director there knew only that a source who wishes to remain unnamed had been forwarding selections from Lilly's papers and electronic communications through Haley's secretary for the past half decade. The source material was scattered all over the cabin, piled unceremoniously like fallen leaves. Much of it was printed from digital sources, as in the case of the accusatory missives from Dr. Stone's assistant, Ehud Lowenstein, about the back door. Files which had more than likely been pinched by Major Levine and passed on to Colley Savine. Harry did not know what would become of the trove, but he was confident that he had already uncovered the lion's share of its gems. Posterity would have to take care of the rest. His relationship with Dr. Lilly had changed in the years since he had murdered the towering man of science for the good of the diaspora he had created. The more he read of the doctor's writings, the more he had to concede that anyone put through the mental and psychological contortions Lilly had experienced would more than likely have ended up just as crazy. Digging deep into the depths of the man's mind laid down in writing, Harry developed a healthy respect for his one-time foe. He did not regret dispatching Lilly from the world, but he did regret that it had been necessary. The same could be said of Harry's late father. Without a doubt, the two had been closer at the moment of the old man's death than they could ever have been in life. Harry knew it was so, and yet he quietly mourned for the circumstances which made their psyches so incompatible. Very likely, his father had done the same for his own relationship with Grandpa Seldon. Harry held the thought delicately in his mind. There was no question of he and Nina reproducing, not with the crosshairs imprinted on their lives. But part of him wondered, if he had a son, would the fallen sergeant's temperament skip a generation? Like his father before him, would Harry look at his son and see the grim ghosts of the past, no longer buried, but alive in flesh and blood once again? Or would the genes of his beloved wife intervene, giving him a kindred soul to cherish unencumbered by the weight of regret, of possibilities unrealized and unreachable. He would never know. But he could not help wondering. Now that a decision had been made, Harry and Nina prepared for their departure as if they had been planning it for years, which was not altogether inaccurate. Both of them knew something about leaving everything behind and embarking on a journey into the unknown. If past was prologue, they would probably be nomads for the rest of their lives. There were worse fates. As the sun began to fall slowly towards the horizon, they looked around and determined that everything they needed was packed. Nina kissed her palm and placed it on the old wooden door, a farewell gesture to their temporary home. She did not cry. Harry tried hard to follow her example. Then he felt the steady thump of Danny's tail on his leg and laughed. He had no idea what to expect, and for now, that was okay. Hoisting the lazy Basset Hound into the special travel pouch Nina had designed for Harry's saddle, they rose up onto their mounts and headed west, without a backward glance. Riding into the sunset, Harry was reminded of his favorite Wayland Lily musing.
In this age, you get your choice of tyrannies. Choose wisely.
Harry had chosen, and in that act, assumed responsibility for all the consequences and glories appertaining thereto. He and Dr. Lily were not so different, both suffused with and driven to action by the tyranny of their own human instincts. It was a fine madness.
Transmission begin. 0647. Danny. Recommission. Power up. 320. Status report. Orbit uniform since last transmission. A window closes. Another opens. We are the dream. We exist and unexist always. It is the same with you. Request respond. Request respond. Decommission power down in 60. Transmission end 0648.
File classified. Holstein Corporation, level 10. Code name, contact initiative. Carol Sims eyes only.
Been listening to the Naive Theater of the Air performance of Rewired, featuring Petra Wright as Dr. Gabriella Neidhart, Levi Ray as Harry, Trista Morris as Nina, Tom Urquhart as Captain Carlos Aguilar, Ed Rogers as Dr. Wayland Lily, Janice McCall as the voice of the satellite, Laura Hickman as the Vorn Queen, and Duleen Broyles as Carol Sims. Written and narrated by Matthew Broyles. Theme music by Paul Shapira. I'm Little Jack Melody. And now, a word from the author.
Well, hello. Here I am, out of character, at the very end of this journey that started. When exactly did it start? In 2007, I was temping at a bank in Dallas. The work was spotty on occasion, and there were gaps in which my mind began to wander. This was at the very dawn of social media, and accessing such things in someone else's office still carried the possibility of consequences. I couldn't work on music, so I began journaling. We were 4 years into the Iraq War, and a lot of people were finally waking up to the reality that they'd been sold a bill of goods. An ardent opponent from the get-go, I started reviewing the kinds of information operations that had been so effective in snowing the public over in 02 and 03. In so doing, I read a lot about propaganda in general, going back to Bernays and the origins of modern advertising in the 1920s. It was a rich vein. The more I explored it, the more the thought crept up on me. What would happen when it was in our brains? Such technology was being discussed even then. And as I wrote, it began to feel like essays and think pieces were ineffective here. Were, in fact, part of the problem. What was needed was a story. I'd tried writing novels in my 20s. They always ended up being little more than thinly veiled autobiography. But I'd learned the lesson of turning the lens outward on my second album, February, which I was very proud of. So this time, I proceeded to create some vessels to tell the tale who were not me. My entry into fatherhood had occurred barely 2 years prior, and the fretting about differences between me and my child was churning along with memories of the divides between myself and my own father. From that swirl of anxiety emerged the father and son at the heart of the narrative. As these characters wandered through this dystopia generated by my fears, they encountered others. Many times these were meant to be incidental bit parts, but as I let them walk around in my head, watched them experience this world from their own perspective, I felt like they needed more attention. Colonel Haley, Dr. Neidhart, Mist, Ricky, each of them had important things to say about the way the world had ended up. And of course, each of them had a piece or two of people I knew in them, not to mention aspects of myself. Once I gave them free rein, the novel began to write itself. I'd been reading a lot of David Mitchell. I'd originally intended to keep the various individual stories more or less separate, but as I watched the ripples of their actions careen off each other, I knew these personalities would all need to collide in the end. Seeing them race towards the final conflict raised my pulse, and I hoped readers would feel the same. I finished writing the novel in 2015 and did the whole thing of shopping into agents and small publishers. I knew it was a niche thing, so I wasn't terribly surprised when that notoriously fickle industry said, thanks, but no thanks. I put it out on my own Naive Books imprint in 2016. I got a similar response to the reactions I usually get from my musical work. There are people who find it unique and fascinating, and others who are simply confused. If you've made it this far, I feel safe in assuming you're one of the former, and I'm grateful to have your attention. Among those who liked it, I got many requests for an audiobook. Having spent 9 years writing it, I wasn't keen on starting a project of that magnitude, especially since I was already ensconced in writing my second novel, Threnody. I put the recommendation on the back burner, but I'd moved on. Jump to 2021. I'd just completed a very topical album, The King in Yellow, with my bandmate Paul Shapira under our Apuk the Destroyer moniker. We were covering many of the same topics: propaganda, media control, corporate dominance. My mind kept turning back to Rewired. At the same time, I was having versions of the same conversation with a lot of people: that nobody had time to read anymore, and that to an extent, that might be by design. The time seemed ripe for an easily digestible audio version, but staring down the prospect of my voice going on and on for hours and hours, I hesitated. Then rather suddenly, I flashed back to a memory. When I was in junior high, I used to check out cassettes from the public library. Orson Welles, Jack Benny, Arch Obler. I was entranced by how effectively these programs transported me to another place and time. Looking at my home studio setup, I realized I could do such a thing myself. But of course, a play needs a cast. I admit I had doubts about assembling enough quality actors for all these parts. Yet I had learned a few things about community in the intervening years. I knew that sometimes, if you simply put something out there, you'll be surprised at the result. So I posted all over social media, a tool whose reach was minimal when I started the book. I put up sample scripts and requests for audition demos. I had absolutely no idea who would reply. But as clips came in, my heart started to race. My ear matched voices to characters, and within a few weeks, the whole lineup was set. There were a few false starts. People who'd committed initially, but had life overtake them midway through. Keep in mind, this was right as the pandemic shutdown was slowly fading out. And a lot of people's situations were volatile. But after some strategic recasting in spots, we pressed on with rehearsals and recording dates. It was a long process. But night by night, session by session, part by part, I heard it coming together. And to a person, every actor brought a degree of enthusiasm, talent, and daring that inspired me to believe that this wasn't just some out-of-control vanity project. Most of these people were stepping way outside of their comfort zones, and their bravery gave me the fuel I needed to push through the trials, technical blips, and scheduling snafus that are inherent in any kind of DIY undertaking. When I finally received Paul's theme in my inbox, my breath caught. As usual, he knew exactly what I was going for. And as I plugged it into the episodes I'd been building, it began feeling more and more real. Like the novel, it took on a life outside of my head and became a fully formed entity in its own right. A whole greater than the sum of its parts. And looking back, I think that's what kept me from making a regular audiobook in the first place. Because this story isn't about me. It's about all of us. As Stephen Prigmore, voice of Ricky Cutler, wrote about the novel when it came out. Good science fiction isn't about the future. It's about right now. But this production isn't simply a statement. It's a community effort, one to which every participant gave their precious time and energy, and as such, I think it's a triumph. I hope you agree. Thank you so much for listening to Rewired. Please pass it on to your friends and let them know how it affected you, because you are a part of this community now, too. You, the listener, are every bit as essential as the voices you hear and the words they speak. Together, maybe we can make a few ripples. And maybe those will reverberate back to an anxious 33-year-old in a dull bank office, letting him know that he's not alone. That he hasn't yet met most of the people who will help bring his crazy dreams to life. Maybe that's something this 50-year-old can remember too. And so, we here at the Naive Theater of the Air bid you farewell. For now. What's next? Don't touch that dial. For now, let's end as we have for the past few months. One more time for Harry, Nina, and their uncertain future, which is, in the end, potentially our own. Good night.